From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. It sometimes seems hard to believe, but there once was a time when presidential campaigns weren't just a collection of sound bites and negative commercials, when the candidates actually debated the issues. On this edition of Fresh Air, political analyst John Ellis discusses his plan to return substance to the campaigns. Also today, veteran actor Hume Cronin talks with us about his half-century in the theater. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the heavy metal band Guns N' Roses. And commentator Maureen Corrigan welcomes Blondie into the 90s. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Yugoslav officials charged today that the Federal Army is out of control in its attack on Croatia. Yugoslav President Stipe Mesic called on army troops to disobey orders and desert. There were reports that the fighting threatened to spill over into the neighboring Republic of Bosnia-Herzegovina, where residents attempted to block federal troops from crossing into Croatia. Observers say that the spread of ethnic fighting into Bosnia could be a disaster because the republic has a volatile population of Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. About 700 army tanks rolled into eastern Croatia today in an apparent attempt to isolate three strategic towns. The Senate Intelligence Committee heard from another witness today who was full of praise for the president's nominee to head up the CIA, Robert Gates. Retired Admiral Bobby Inman, Gates' predecessor as deputy director, testified that then-CIA Director William Casey ran the agency in a way that most likely kept Gates from knowledge of the Iran-Contra affair. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Inman served under Casey for 2 years and says the director ran the spy agency in a compartmented way. He says it's probable that Gates was kept out of the loop.
One of the things that's drilled into you is you don't ask what's going on in an area that you're not cleared for.
Inman praised Gates as the right person to head up the agency when Congress and the administration need to rethink intelligence needs. He says criticism of Gates within the agency may have to do with his rapid career rise. We moved him along faster than we should have, he said. He broke some china on the way. Testimony this week has mainly been favorable and supportive of Gates and his assertion that he knew little of the Iran-Contra diversion. Next week, the committee will meet in executive session to question agency analysts about whether Gates slanted intelligence to suit policy goals. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar says he remains hopeful Western hostages in Beirut will be released. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The Revolutionary Justice Organization announced yesterday that it would not set free any more hostages until Israel released 20 more Arab prisoners. The announcement dashed hopes that a Westerner, probably Jack Mann of Britain, was about to be let go. Today, Perez de Cuellar told reporters he had not lost faith. He said he was not dealing with governments, but with groups, and so the talks were taking a while.
I think that we have to be patient. I think that we have now evidence that there is the desire of solving this problem.
Perez de Cuellar has been working on a deal to trade the Western hostages and five missing Israeli servicemen for approximately 300 Arabs held in an Israeli-controlled prison. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
And this is National Public Radio News. A panel of experts told the Food and Drug Administration today that there's no scientific reason to put warning labels on the antidepressant drug Prozac. The scientists were responding to claims of violent behavior and suicide by people taking the drug. A number of people told the panel today of personal experiences with Prozac, including some who called it a killer drug and begged that it be taken off the market. The Finance Committee of Israel's parliament today approved an allocation of $6.5 million for projects in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem that the approval was originally scheduled for the same day that Secretary of State Baker was in Israel.
Israel and the administration are locked in a dispute over Israel's request for $10 billion in loan guarantees for the absorption of immigrants, a request President Bush once delayed until after the start of a Middle East peace process. Throughout American efforts to arrange a regional conference, President Bush and Secretary of State Baker have repeatedly expressed their opposition to expansion of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. Today's allocation passed despite objections by members of opposition parties who sit on the parliamentary committee. Among the opponents was Labour Party whip Chaim Ramon.
To invest more money in the settlements is close to insanity.
Chaim Ramon said the Israeli government would be investing around $2 billion in housing and infrastructure in the territories in the coming fiscal year. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
The Commerce Department said today that growing foreign investment in the United States over the past decade has done the economy more good than harm. A department spokesman told Congress Joint Economic Committee that on average, foreign companies tend to spend more on plant and equipment, research and development, and worker pay than do firms in the United States. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. President Bush's popularity has not dampened the desires of Democrats to take him on. This week, Senator Bob Kerry announced that he will formally declare his candidacy at the end of the month. Kerry will join Paul Tsongas, Governor Douglas Wilder, and Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, the other announced candidates. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton is also expected to throw his hat in the ring sometime soon. Most of us will get to know the candidates from the sound bites on the nightly TV news. A new study proposes changing the quality of TV campaign coverage. Its author is my guest, political consultant John Ellis. For many years, he was a political analyst at NBC News. While a fellow at the Joan Shorstein Barone Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard, he designed a study called Nine Sundays. It's a plan for a series of debates and conversations with the candidates to be broadcast for 9 Sunday evenings between Labor Day and Election Day. Ellis said in preparation for his proposal, he studied how campaigns have been covered in the media since 1960.
In 1968, just to give you some idea, there were three candidates running, Nixon, Humphrey, and Wallace. Generally speaking, a piece on the CBS Evening News or the NBC Nightly News or the ABC News would start with the correspondent saying President Nixon went to Chicago today, and then you would hear a bite of President Nixon or then whatever Richard Nixon talking, and he would talk for 30 seconds. Then you'd come back to the correspondent, and the correspondent would do a bridge, and then Nixon would speak again. The average length of the soundbite, quote-unquote, in 1968 was somewhere between 42 and 45 seconds of hearing these people speak. And over the course of 70 days, you really got a sense of what these people were talking about and what they were like and how they dealt with different issues and so on and so forth. That, it wasn't by any means, thorough, but it gave you a look at it. Now, flash forward to 1988, I was working at NBC News at the time, and in September on the NBC Nightly News, from September 1 to September 30, this total time of all of the sound bites for George Bush and Michael Dukakis was 1 minute and 37 seconds for George Bush and about 2.5 minutes for Michael Dukakis for the entire month of September on the NBC Nightly News. You can't talk about the issues facing the country in that short a time frame. You can't.
The centerpiece of your proposal is a series of TV programs to be broadcast on 9 Sunday evenings between Labor Day and just before the elections. What would viewers see if they tuned in?
Because we don't really have any control over it, but we suppose that like 1984 and 1988, there will be 2 presidential debates, 1 vice-presidential debate. We propose that on the last Sunday before Election Day, the candidates be given 20 to 25 minutes each to speak back-to-back and make a sort of summary case for their candidacies. On the 5 remaining Sunday evenings, we propose that the candidates be part of something called what we called conversations with the candidates, which would feature a television anchorman, 2 reporters knowledgeable in that evening's subject area, and the candidate, say President Bush, from 7 o'clock to 7:45, followed by Bill Clinton, let's say, from 7:46 to 8:30.
Getting to this whole issue of debates, how are you going to get two candidates to engage each other in a political debate? Because I think it's very clear the way that the debates have been set up in the most recent election is that these are not debates.
Right.
No one is debating each other there.
They're sort of like press panels or whatever. Well, we came up with we went back and looked at all of the coverage going back to 1960, and we thought that the best format for presidential debates was the Nixon-Kennedy format of 1960, which is basically the two candidates in a television studio with one moderator to keep time and keep things moving along. No audience, live, put it up at 9 o'clock on Sunday night and let them go until 10:30.
What kind of an audience do debates normally get?
Huge. The last debate of the Bush-Dukakis race was seen by about 78 million people.
You have made this proposal voluntary. I'm wondering what incumbent, and if we're talking about President George Bush, this is a person who's way ahead in the polls. Why would he agree to a series of programs that could shed some critical light on some of his programs and policies? It seems like it's a program that certainly favors the underdog.
I suspect that on first glance it probably does. But I think that the situation is roughly this. President Bush will probably have to do two debates anyway. President Reagan did two debates in 1984. Candidate Bush did two debates in 1988. You know, he's probably, that's sort of agreed that you should have at least two debates in a presidential campaign. So he's going to have to do that anyway. Vice President Quayle is going to have to do his one debate. The closing speeches, I think that works to their advantage. They give a speech on national television. What's left then are five conversations with the candidates, sort of mini press conferences, which happens to be the format which Mr. Bush is most comfortable with, he is most comfortable, and where he has over the course of these last 3 years been enormously effective.
What has the response of the networks been to these ideas?
The network response has been chilly from CBS because the nine Sundays, five of the nine Sundays, run up against the 60 Minutes broadcast, which is their most profitable and that's their sort of showcase piece, so that they're uncomfortable in doing anything that changes the chemistry on Sunday night. From NBC, we have received positive, positive feedback from Michael Gartner, who's the president of the news division, and we've also received some encouraging words from Capital Cities ABC. PBS, CNN, C-SPAN, Monitor have all been generally positive and supportive.
Do you have fantasies of trying to make this the law to make sure that it happens?
No, I think that was a debate that we had at the Joan Shorenstein Barone Center, and we decided that we didn't want it to be part of any legislation. We wanted it to be strictly voluntary. Hope that the networks do it in 1992. If it works in 1992, maybe it'll be a model for 1996 and beyond.
And are you hopeful?
Yeah, well, I thought 2 months ago, I thought that this had about a 1 in 20 chance of flying. We released it right after Labor Day. The New York Times editorial pages have been enormously supportive. We receive great support from the Chicago Tribune, Philadelphia Inquirer, Boston Globe and other papers. We received a lot of support from certain Democratic presidential candidates. I'm much more hopeful now. I think if I had to judge the chances of it working out, I'd say 1 in 4.
What do you see as the defining issues in this 92 campaign? What will the candidates be talking about?
I think the issues are pretty much always the same. I think there are three basic issues: the national security, military preparedness and diplomacy, foreign policy, the use of force internationally, That's one group, national security. The next is the national economy, which is a bit of a misnomer because we are increasingly dealing in a international economy. But nevertheless, how the economy performs is always a major issue in campaigns. And finally, the national culture, and by that I mean what kind of country do we want to live in? What about K through 12 education, so on and so forth? I think those are always the three issues. I think the Republicans have an advantage right now in all three, which makes it much more difficult for the Democrats to win.
Can these candidates, whoever they are in the Democratic Party, criticize a president like George Bush, who is so popular, criticize him without losing votes or paying a kind of political price for their words?
Well, there's a President Bush politically is sort of a twin tower. He's like the World Trade Center in New York. There is his personal popularity, which is enormous and which is, I think, unbreakable. And there is his political popularity, which is much more dependent upon economic factors, international factors, and matters of culture, broadly defined. The Democrats would be insane to attack him on the personal level, but the attacks which are leveled against matters of policy and politics are, I think, dealt with by the public as fair and square.
I'm speaking with John Ellis. He's a consultant to the Institute of Politics at Harvard University. He's also a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Times, and he's the author of a study and a proposal actually called Nine Sundays, a proposal for better presidential campaign coverage. Well, one candidate that doesn't seem to shy away from personal attacks against George Bush is Harkin. And when he talks about George Bush, he calls him George Herbert Walker Bush. Of course, I think the message to his audience is that this is a man with upper class roots that doesn't understand the needs of working class people. Is this message going to work? Is Harkin going to be able to kind of revive a kind of populist presidential campaign?
Well, I think that it depends on the audience. I think that the little long-winded answer here, the party out of power facing a fairly hopeless task will quite often return to its where it's most comfortable ideologically. In 1964, the Republicans facing Lyndon Johnson, you know, no hope there, they went with Barry Goldwater. In 1972, facing a very strong Richard Nixon, Democrats, no hope there, they went with George McGovern. 1984, facing a very strong Ronald Reagan, no hope there, they went where they were most comfortable, Walter Mondale. 1992, you know, very tough uphill, probably no hope there. It may be that that Tom Harkin's populist message will attract a real following.
Well, what Harkin seems to be doing is something that Michael Dukakis did not do, which is to fight anyway. I mean, to fight with words. And I think Dukakis was criticized by many people by sort of rolling over when President Bush and his campaign brought out a kind of nasty side to the whole election process.
Well, the other thing is that what Harkin and Dukakis have in common is that they don't have the experience of having run nationally. In 1980, George Bush was absolutely savaged by the forces aligned with Ronald Reagan in New Hampshire and in the South, and, you know, his wife was an abortionist and so on and so forth. He learned from that experience what it was like to be under brutal attack. Dukakis and now Harkin were unfamiliar with what that feels like, what it's like to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and hear on national public radio that you're some kind of criminal coddler and abortionist or whatever it might be. That's tough. takes a lot out of you, and you have to have some experience in dealing with it. Makes it difficult for Harkin. Now he's pretty glib and he's got some nice lines and he flashes these suitcases. Showing President Bush's foreign travel, but when you're in it and it's 60-day fire drill and you're fighting, you know, all sorts of different pressures, it helps to have been through the experience before.
Can anyone say that George Bush will win next year? I mean, can anyone guarantee that at this point in the game?
No, you can never guarantee. You can never guarantee that. On the other hand, if you're in Las Vegas, I would urge you to not bet against Mr. Bush.
So you're not going to put your money on Harkin or any of these other guys?
No, I think we'll be betting on the primaries, but the general election will lay off that one.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, John Ellis, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
John Ellis is the author of a proposal designed to improve the quality of presidential campaigns. It's called Nine Sundays, referring to nine Sunday evenings of presidential debates and conversations, which would take place between Labor Day and Election Day. Ellis consults to the Institute of Politics at Harvard and is a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Times. This is Fresh Air. The pop event of the season is the release earlier this week of Use Your Illusion by the hard rock band Guns N' Roses. Many record stores across the country opened early and stayed open late to accommodate the increased numbers of customers for the albums. Use Your Illusion is the band's first collection since 1988, and it's being sold in two separate volumes that total 30 songs and over 2.5 hours of music. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Rock critics are falling all over themselves to line up behind the millions of young rock fans who are opening their hearts and wallets for Use Your Illusion Volumes 1 and 2. To put the band in some perspective for those of you who don't have a handle on Guns N' Roses, this is nothing less than the most highly esteemed hard rock act since the Rolling Stones. Guns N' Roses emerged from Los Angeles about 6 years ago, led by lead singer Axl Rose. His immediate distinction was a voice that combines the roar of a chainsaw with the whine of a spoiled adolescent. It's a sound that slices through the thick power chords of the lead guitarist named Slash. On much of Use Your Illusion, Guns N' Roses' trademark attack is revved up to high speed. Typical Guns N' Roses music, an intense conflation of the past 20 years of the hardest rock, from the Stones to the Sex Pistols, with Guns N' Roses positioning themselves as the definitive, decadent end of the line. The size of this collection signals the band's ambition, and Guns N' Roses includes a number of long, rambling set pieces that are supposed to convince us of their seriousness. This, for example, is November Rain.
Nothing lasts forever, and
Obviously, the band intends Use Your Illusion to be a grand gesture, a major statement. So the most important question to ask is, what is the band trying to express? Well, as a musical expression of self-obsessed mean-spiritedness and inarticulate rage, Use Your Illusion is just about definitive. I really can't think of another collection of songs that offers such sustained hatred and contempt for one's fellow man, and especially woman. I'll spare you a little ditty called Back Off Bitch, but I will subject you to the second verse of You Ain't the First, a low-volume, nearly acoustic composition that allows you to really hear just how much Axl Rose despises the woman he's dumping.
Time can pass slowly, things always change. Your day's been numbered and I've read your last page. You was just a temporary lover, honey, you ain't the first. Lots of others come before you, woman said, but you've been the worst. You've been the worst.
In the past, Axl Rose has tried to justify his sentiments by using the Andrew Dice Clay defense, saying that the band's lyrics don't state their own beliefs, but those of other characters who are far more ignorant than Guns N' Roses are. This excuse was first employed in 1988 when the band's song One in a Million heaped abuse upon black people, homosexuals, and, how quaint, immigrants. But Use Your Illusion exposes their excuse as a lie once and for all. On a song here called Don't Damn Me, Rose says, I send this song to the offended, I said what I meant and I never pretended. This is about as upfront as you can get about it, and also, I must admit, an awfully well-written couplet with meter and rhyme that would do a poet proud. Millions of fans can't be entirely wrong. Though their sentiments are reprehensible, this is not a band without talent.
He lost his mind today. He left it out back on the highway. I-65. She loved him yesterday.
That's Dust and Bones. If only all of Use Your Illusion were as concise. Instead, the collection is padded out with overblown tripe like Coma, a 10-minute salute to insensibility. I freely admit that I stopped listening to it when Axl yelled, "Somebody tell me what the expletive is going on." I figured if he didn't know after 7 minutes or so, I didn't want to. There's a difference between dramatizing adolescent self-absorption and embodying it. On a song called Breakdown, Rose moans, "When I look around, everybody always brings me down." This is nothing new. It's just Axl turning himself into a rude, crude version of Sylvia Plath. Ultimately, a lot of Use Your Illusion should be sealed up in a bell jar.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. When Hume Cronyn first started acting, a casting director told him he didn't look like anything. But despite that nondescript face, he went on to have a long and distinguished career in film and on stage. Coming up, we look back with Hume Cronyn. And you may have noticed a big change in the comics page of your local newspaper. After years of tending house, Blondie's getting a job. Commentator Maureen Corrigan examines the ramifications. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. This afternoon in Capitol Hill, the Senate Judiciary Committee wrapped up its nomination hearings on the appointment of Judge Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
After 8 days of testimony and some 90 witnesses, the Thomas hearings were the third longest in history. 4 years ago, hearings on the nomination of Robert Bork took 12 days, and hearings on the nomination of Louis Brandeis in 1916 took 3 weeks. Today, as soon as the Judiciary Committee hearings were complete, Republican committee member Arlen Specter announced he will vote in favor of Thomas, thus assuring that all 6 Republicans on the Judiciary Committee will be supporting the nominee. As for the 8 Democrats, Senate sources said there are 4 solid votes against Thomas and 3 more possible no votes. A committee vote is expected next week or the week following. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Capitol.
At Detroit, a Continental Airlines jet has made an emergency landing, skidding in with no activated landing gear. It is not immediately known whether there were any injuries. Officials say that the runway was coated with fire-retardant foam for the 727's landing. Authorities say that the landing occurred within the hour. The flight number, number of passengers or crew on board, and point of origin are not immediately available. Senators have introduced a measure that would repeal a law that levels penalties against employers who hire illegal immigrants. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Capitol Hill.
The 1986 Immigration Reform Law provided for fines of up to $10,000 and up to 6 months in prison for employers who knowingly hire illegal immigrants. The bill introduced today by Democrat Ted Kennedy and Republican Orrin Hatch would get rid of those penalties. Hatch and Kennedy cited a General Accounting Office survey that suggested the sanctions have led to discrimination against U.S. citizens who appear to be foreign. According to a civil rights organization that supports the bill, 900,000 employers have adopted discriminatory hiring practices in order to avoid the penalties. In place of the penalties for businesses who hire undocumented workers, the authors of the new measure are proposing to increase the number of Border Patrol officers. I'm Mara Liasson reporting.
Hearings continue today on Capitol Hill in the nomination of Robert Gates to head the CIA. Winding up a week of testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, retired Admiral Bobby Inman had praise for the nominee and said that there was no reason to doubt that the late CIA Director William Casey would not have told Gates in detail about the Iran-Contra affair. Gates has insisted, as former number 2 man at CIA, that he did not know about the arms profit diversions. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 5 points to close at 3,019.23. This is NPR News. Yugoslavia, the Federal Army, has gone on attack against Croatia, sending troops and tanks into the breakaway republic and warships to hit at coastal targets. The acting president of the federal government said that the military is acting with no backing from the federal government and called on troops to lay down their arms and take the side of the people. Officials in Croatia have accused the army of siding with Serbian forces in fighting in which the breakaway republic has lost 1/3 of its territory. A team of UN inspectors is slated to arrive in Iraq tomorrow to inspect nuclear facilities there. This team is to provide a backup to another group of experts who said Iraq has been hampering their efforts. Larry James reports from Nicosia.
The inspectors hope to gain access to installations which might be involved in Iraq's nuclear weapons program. The United States and its Gulf War allies have charged Saddam Hussein's government with trying to deny access to other teams of experts from the International Atomic Energy Agency. President Bush said this week he's fed up with Iraq's attitude, and Pentagon officials said they had plans to send American warplanes to Saudi Arabia to force Iraq to allow the inspections. Last week, UN teams said they were denied permission to use their own helicopters to conduct the checks. Baghdad later okayed the use of the aircraft, but insisted an Iraqi official be on board. A larger team of between 24 and 30 UN experts is due in Iraq next month. For National Public Radio, I'm Larry James in Nicosia.
In New York City, officials at Salomon Brothers say that two more instances of unauthorized bids in U.S. Treasury auctions have been uncovered. The company reported four auction violations last month. In other admitted violations, Salomon bought more than the 35% ceiling under bidding rules covering auctions of U.S. government securities. In trading today in Europe, the U.S. dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Hume Cronin and Jessica Tandy make up one of America's most famous acting couples. Jessica Tandy's most recent fame comes from her starring role in the Academy Award-winning film Driving Miss Daisy. My guest, Hume Cronin, co-starred most recently in Cocoon and its sequel, Cocoon the Return. Tandy and Cronin have been married for almost 50 years and have worked together in movies and plays for many of them. Hume Cronin's film career goes back to the early 40s. He worked with Hitchcock on a number of films and wrote the screenplays for such films as Rope. He's also directed and produced for stage, film, and television. Hume Cronin grew up in Canada, where he had a privileged Victorian upbringing.
In some respects, it was very rich, and certainly it was comfortable. I was very fortunate in that I was born into very comfortable circumstances. But life was, I thought, my going into the theater was rebellion in part. I thought it was stuffy and narrow. There was a procedure about everything. Everything was done in a certain fashion and manner. And manners were very important. Ideas, I think, were inclined to be ossified. They were formal, and that's what one did. One did do this, one did not do that. One behaved in a certain fashion, and it was unthinkable to behave differently.
Was there any kind of comfort in that sort of order?
I mean, tremendous comfort.
Instance, you write about Christmas Day. I mean, the kind of how that day progressed was, it was almost out of a manual in a way.
Well, that's right. But it was tremendously comfortable. I mean, it was even, in a way, luxurious. But the pattern had been set years before, and you stuck with that pattern. There wasn't a great deal in life that, you know, from my point of view, I kicked all that when I went off to university, and from university went right to New York. And there, my life couldn't have been more different.
Coming from this well-known and wealthy Canadian family, what was their reaction when you told them that you wanted to be an actor? I think they wanted you to be an attorney.
When I actually said, this is what I want to do, and I was already at university, and I wanted to leave after my freshman year. My father was ill and really couldn't join in the conversations about what I was going to do with my life. My two older brothers, much older, 17 and 18 years older than I am, both gone now, but they had the responsibility with my mother of deciding just which direction I was going to take. And one of my brothers, to whom I was absolutely devoted, we were a very close family, turned to me during this conversation in which I talked about going into the theater, and he said to me, Hume, how many years do you think you can afford to waste? That was a chiller, and I was furious.
Did that make you want to reconsider your decision?
Oh, no, just had the opposite effect. And I got up and I walked away from the meeting. We were sitting out in the garden having afternoon tea, which was just one of many rituals in the household. And I just walked out of the garden and away down the street and walked for 2 or 3 hours, had dinner somewhere, came home, and My mother's light was still on. And she called to me when I came in, and she said, "You mustn't be angry with them. They're only worrying about your welfare." And then she said, "I'll make a bargain with you. If you'll go back to college for one more year, finish your sophomore year, and you still want to do this," she didn't say mad thing, but "I'll see to it that you go to either the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, England, or the American Academy of Dramatic Art in New York." I didn't suspect she even knew those two institutions existed. But I think she'd done a lot of thinking about it. I think she'd seen which way I was leaning, and I think she'd made a considerable number of inquiries.
What was your attraction to acting?
Escape, I think. I led what psychiatrists would call a very rich fantasy life. I was so much younger than my brothers and sisters that I was brought up, in one sense, almost like an only child. I wasn't born until my mother was 45. I was alone, and I was shipped off, not unkindly, by the way, but I was shipped off to boarding schools when I was just 7.
You came to New York City in order to make your mark in the theater, and a casting director said to you, "You don't look like anything." Did that give you a kind of freedom then to explore, and others maybe to give you that kind of freedom to explore a whole range of characters?
At the time, it just shocked me deeply. She was actually, she didn't know that she would scar me when she said it. She was actually trying to be very kind and understanding. She said, "Mr. Cronin, I think I should tell you that you may have a difficult time." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because you don't look like anything." That's not the kind of comment you forget. And then, feeling that she might have been offensive, she immediately covered her tracks very nicely and said, I mean that your best chances of getting a job with nothing but an amateur's experience would be to walk into an office where they are looking for just your type." And she said, "I don't know what your type is. Your accent is not just like ours on this side of the border. And you dress rather differently. Very nicely, of course, but differently. I find it hard to know just who's going to say, ah, that's exactly what we're looking for."
What kind of roles did you have then early on in your career?
Name it.
You did it. And that's
been played all sorts of things.
And that's really continued.
And most of them are a great deal older than I actually was. I mean, I've gone the whole gamut now from when I started. It was, "I'm afraid you're too young. I'm afraid you're too young. Oh, but you look so young. But you're very young." Now, of course, it's, "But you're a bit old, aren't you?" We think we should have somebody younger. They're careful about saying that. When you're young, nobody minds saying to you, "You look too young." Mm. When you're old, they hesitate to say, "You look too old."
Hume Cronin is my guest, and he has had a career in theater, film, and television, and he's worked as an actor, writer, director, and producer, and he's just written a book about his life. It's called A Terrible Liar. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor Hume Cronin is my guest. You moved out to Hollywood, and I believe one of your early films was an Alfred Hitchcock film called Shadow of a Doubt. You write that it was really the beginning of a new life for you. What was it like to work with Hitchcock?
Well, it was a marvelous experience. I think I learned a great deal from him. I admired him tremendously. He took me to California. He gave me my first film job, and I I appeared in two films he directed, Shadow of a Doubt and Lifeboat. And then I wrote the treatment of two films for him, Rope and Under Capricorn. And we became good friends and remained so until he died. He was a fascinating character, and of course I've never met anybody who knew so much about making film as he did.
You even write that he seemed to enjoy tremendous technical problems, that those were kind of a challenge to him.
Exactly. I mean, films like, for instance, consider how the problems of making a film like Rear Window, which is tremendously successful, where everything had to be shot from the point of view of Jimmy Stewart looking through that window into an apartment across the alley. That limitation would have driven 99.9% of other directors away from the script altogether. They wouldn't have even attempted it. The birds, I mean, the problems involved in handling the birds, I'm talking about the live birds in that film, were enormous. In Rope, which I did the treatment, he decided that the nature of the story should be told almost in its own time, as it were, and in one situation. So we stayed inside one room, and we shot. Every take was the length of a reel of film, which was at that time about 20 minutes. And the film had to be very, very, very carefully rehearsed. There were no takes of, 15 seconds or 2 minutes or 3 or 4 minutes. Once you started, you were on for 20 minutes, and if you blew it, you had to go right back and start the reel over again. That sort of thing seemed to fascinate Hitchcock. He was a master of almost every aspect of filmmaking.
You have collaborated with your wife, Jessica Tandy, really from just about the beginning of your acting careers.
Well, working with her has been an absolute delight. I mean, speaking generally, it doesn't always go smoothly any more than marriage does. I mean, it's a tough contract to live up to, marriage. And it's a tough contract in the theater to work with somebody over and over and over again. I mean, if you asking these questions, how would you like it if every question you asked, someone else was listening and thinking, she didn't ask that question quite right, or she could have asked it better, or she shouldn't have asked it at all. And you never were free of your job without someone standing over your shoulder and perhaps giving you another opinion, or standing behind you and patting you on the shoulder. I mean, it works both ways. But you work together, share the same bed, the same breakfast table, same rehearsal hall, the same performance, same stage, same supper, week after week, month after month, year after year. If you're lucky enough to be in a hit and it runs that long, it can become trying. And where Jessie is so wonderful is that she understands the need for some degree of separation, some degree of escape, some degree of aloneness. I don't mean loneliness. I mean being left alone.
You've been in certainly on the stage, television, movies. Do you have a preference for one of those mediums over another?
Yes, the theater.
Why?
The stage. Oh, because I think it's the most difficult. Because it's the greatest challenge, because I have a far greater degree of control. Once the curtain goes up in the theater on the stage, it's up to the actor. Nobody can meddle. There's no cutter, no editor, no director who can change anything. The director makes an enormous contribution, if he's any good, when you're rehearsing. But once it's turned over to you and it's just you and the audience, it is just you and the audience.
Hume Cronyn, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
You're welcome.
Actor Hume Cronyn, he's just written a memoir called A Terrible Liar.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered. Robert, what stories do you have for us today?
We have reports from Capitol Hill, where there are confirmation hearings for Judge Clarence Thomas. This is the last day of testimony. Also for President Bush's nominee to direct the Central Intelligence Agency, Robert Gates. And we'll be hearing another story about affirmative action, this time two views of the same affirmative action hire at a university. One by a professor who was on the search team that looked for a minority candidate, and the other, the view of the candidate who was hired. They both published their stories recently, and we'll be hearing what they make of the process.
Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you only read the front sections of your newspapers, you've been missing one of the most startling political transformations of 1991, the emancipation of Blondie. After decades of being a housewife, she's decided to go out and get a job. Commentator Maureen Corrigan hasn't been this excited about a comic strip since the Flintstones ran their Name the Baby contest for Baby Pebbles.
How ironic. Just when they've stopped singing the Internationale in Moldavia, Latvia, and the rest of those breakaway republics, Blondie has embraced its liberating message in her comic strip. Arise, ye prisoners of starvation, arise, ye wretched of the earth, for justice thunders condemnation, a better world's at birth. The women's movement has finally reached Blondie's corner of Toontown. I knew that one day Blondie's consciousness would be raised, but it was hard for her to find role models. It's true, some of her pioneering comic strip sisters, Kathy, Winnie Winkle, Lois of High and Lois, have pursued autonomous careers. But Blondie hung out with that older married crowd, Mrs. Snuffy Smith, Mrs. Andy Capp, Mrs. Hagar the Horrible. They're all stuck in a pre-feminist age. And the rest of the women in Toontown are either real witches like Broomhilda, martyrs like Mary Worth, or Miss America wannabes like Miss Buxley in Beetle Bailey. What a reactionary crew. Over the decades, Blondie's resentment of her second-class status surfaced in indirect ways. Remember how she always invited that irritating kid Elmo into the house whenever Dagwood was napping or soaking in the tub? Something had to change. Their marriage was about to snap. But two Sundays ago, when Blondie announced that she was updating their gender roles, what did Dagwood say? The wife of Dagwood Bumstead will never work. He's so transparent. He masks his chauvinism under the veneer of chivalry. If Dagwood wants to be such a shining knight, why doesn't he move into Prince Valiant's boring old strip? Fortunately, Blondie wasn't cowed. She's starting a catering business with her newly liberated friend Tootsie. This past Sunday, Dagwood even encouraged the idea once Blondie told him that she projected a first-year income of over $20,000. But if Blondie really wants to be the next Martha Stewart, she's going to have to make some major image changes. No more boo-hooing. Women who cry in the workplace never break through the glass ceiling. And those blonde ringlets and powder blue frocks will have to go. According to the October issue of Working Women, pantsuits are a must for professional women. Blondie would look stunning in that double-breasted suit by Donna Karan. It's $1,950, but as Blondie will find out, working women have to work just so they can afford the right clothes to work in. There'll have to be some shakeups on the home front, too. Dagwood needs to assume more responsibility for parenting his teenagers, Cookie and Alexander. He's also going to have to do his share of cleaning and preparing meals. Well, he's always been good at making those sandwiches. Somehow, though, I can't see Dagwood scrubbing the tub in his George Will bow ties. In Arlie Hochschild's groundbreaking book, The Second Shift, she discovered that middle-class men like Dagwood were more reluctant than their working-class counterparts to shoulder the burden of housework. Dagwood will probably hire Hazel part-time and evade the issue. It looks like the Bumstead homestead will be a bit low on laughs in the future. But on the bright side, Blondie's long-belated entry into the workforce is the most progressive piece of news about a women's issue that I've found in the comic strips or any other part of the paper lately.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller with Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tui, Roberta Shorrock, and Sue Spolin. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Clive Barker's books and movies have both terrified and entertained us. On the next edition of Fresh Air, Clive Barker discusses his latest novel and tells us why it's good to be scared. That and more on the next Fresh Air.